Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, presented on Sunday, October 20th, 2024, is by the Reverend Tom Hackett on the topic of Are Ethics and Morality Still Relevant?
A reading from Sean Carroll. If our feelings, our thoughts, our consciousness, our sense of being, our sense of self, cannot in principle be reduced to the movements of the trillions upon trillions of atoms forming the multiple trillions of molecules which make up the billions upon billions of cells that make up each one of our bodies, then maybe there is more to moral behavior, more to systems of ethics than the attempt of our genes to ensure their own survival. We are made of the same stuff as the rest of the universe, but our stuff is assembled in just the right way that a new way of talking about ourselves becomes appropriate. We have the capacity to contemplate alternatives and to make choices. It is not a mystical or supernatural ability giving us the right to flout the laws of physics. It is a way of talking about who we are that captures some of the power of the complex systems we call human beings. And with great power comes great responsibility. In an article appearing in the September 16th issue of The New Yorker, Manveer Singh, an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of California, Davis, asks whether we live in a post-moral age. He seems to think that we do. Belief in objective moral truths, existing apart from our minds and discoverable through impartial judgment, he asserts, has grown increasingly untenable. This is not a new idea. Michel de Montaigne in the 16th century doubted the existence of universal moral truths. In the 18th century, philosopher David Hume argued that judgments of right and wrong are not the result of logical reasoning, but rather the result of emotion and social conditioning. To bolster this position, Singh turns to the findings of evolutionary biology. We behave morally, we often say, not because of doctrine, but because of our high-order principles, such as resisting cruelty or upholding the equality of all humans. Do I hear echoes of the worth and dignity of every person or justice, equity, and compassion in human relations? In contrast to such reasoning, Singh asserts, based on the findings, or maybe I should say the assertions of evolutionary biology, that humans have been fashioned by natural selection to pursue sex, status, and material resources. Indeed, we do help people, providing individually or through government agencies paid for by our taxes, by donating to the UUSC or contributing to disaster relief. But the decision to do so is, according to this rendering, influenced or driven by selfish considerations. We trust people who are guided by consistent ethical principles, Singh continues, but we're turned off when people's commitments seem calculated. So we adopt moral principles to cultivate the appearance of praiseworthiness. But they're really a smokescreen to distract people from our inherent selfishness. Supposedly, independent moral truths are the result of an ever-evolving project invented by our remote ancestors and continually refined to help societies flourish. In other words, they keep us out of trouble. The upshot of this perspective is that the desire to be good is exposed as a self-serving performance. By the end of his article, Singh asserts that he has moral intuitions and that he tries to do right by people. He seems uneasy with his conclusion that morality is at the root a performance to make one likable to others. Let's see if we can help him out. At about the time I came across Singh's article on the post-moral age, an associate of mine of the New York State Convention of Universalists Executive Board happened to remark that she was reading a book by Sean Carroll called The Big Picture. I borrowed a copy from the library and was soon intrigued by how closely Carroll's discussion paralleled the views that I began to develop as an undergraduate philosophy major. Carroll is a physicist by profession and inclination. He begins his book by elucidating the fundamental nature of reality from that point of view. That point of view is the core theory of quantum fields. But he also touches on philosophical areas such as ontology, epistemology, logic, and ethics. He points out the strengths of the core theory in explaining scientific observations of such things as atoms, electrons, protons, and their constituent particles, of electromagnetism, gravity, and so forth. One could imagine that armed with the concepts and truths of the core theory, it should, since the core theory encompasses all of the fundamental constituents of matter and the forces that act on it, it should be capable of predicting the future. If you knew, for instance, the position and state of all the atoms that make up the billions of cells in Yankee pitcher Carlos Rodon's body as he stands on the mound, you should be able to calculate, using core theory, whether the next pitch is a ball or a strike. Whatever you found out through that calculation will be wrong, because no game six will be necessary. New information since I wrote this. Basic simple stuff. But even thinking along those lines involves a categorical mistake. There is so much more that goes into the next pitch, never mind the outcome of the game or of the World Series. Psychology, neurology, even medicine, that the core theory, even the entire corpus of knowledge in the field of physics, is hopeless in making such a prediction. A categorical error is talking about one realm of human experience as if it were entirely comprehended by another, such as physics. For our purposes, it would be talking about ethics and morality as if they were physics or biology or neurology. Nature doesn't guide us or lay down rules or even author exemplars of good behavior. Nature is kind of a mess. We can be inspired by it and occasionally horrified by it, but nature simply is. In order to make some sense of the relationship between truths from different but related realms, some scientists and philosophers have introduced the term emergence. The idea of emergence is that from one level of reality or plane of existence, an entirely different but no less real set of properties can manifest themselves. Some examples may be in order. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Vincent van Gogh's painting, Starry Night. If not, imagine any oil or watercolor painting you are familiar with. Physically, it is a collection of atoms and molecules at certain locations. There are molecules of paint whose atoms reflect specific colors of light. These are bound to the fibers of a fabric we call canvas. When we look at it, however, that's not what we see. We see stars, somewhat surrealistic, but nonetheless recognizable. We see houses, a church with a steeple, mountains in the background, and a glowing crescent moon. We can say that these objects emerge from the atoms and molecules. There are no house atoms or church atoms or star atoms. A physical or chemical description of the painting does not itself tell us what it is a painting of, but we recognize it easily. We can say that the features of the painting, the represented objects, the mood, the style, emerge from the physical layer. No analysis of the atoms making up the paint gives us stars or buildings. Another example is the air in this room. We can talk about it in terms of temperature or barometric pressure or humidity. Each of these characteristics is perfectly valid and can be studied scientifically. Yet the air is a collection of atoms. We can talk about its composition in terms of molecules of nitrogen or oxygen or of water, which itself consists of atoms, two of hydrogen and one of oxygen. These are three different ways of talking about air. They use different vocabularies and have a different domain of applicability. Yet each description is true and can be scientifically studied. The important takeaway here is that stories can involve utterly different ideas and yet accurately describe the same underlying stuff. The 18th and 19th century philosopher Auguste Comte is known for his description of a hierarchy of sciences. His ordering went from the simpler to the more complex, those with general applicability to the more specific. Astronomy, physics, chemistry, biology, and sociology. Around 200 years later, we might recognize a different list. We could add on top of biology, neuroscience, or even medicine. What matters, though, is not the existence of a hierarchy, but the existence of different ways of talking that describe the same underlying world and are compatible with each other when their domains of applicability overlap. Another, perhaps more difficult to comprehend, example of emergence is human consciousness. All humans, with a few tragic exceptions, experience consciousness. Descartes and the 16th and 17th French philosopher famously said, "Cogito ergo sum," I think, therefore I am. We might say, I am conscious, therefore I am. I am aware of myself as something distinguished from my environment. I have a relatively continuous collection of memories that seem to belong to me and not to someone else. I would never agree with someone who said to me, "You do not exist." Even if I am a body whose brain is being fed by a computer simulation, as in the film The Matrix, I still have the sensation of being. But what is consciousness really? Where is it located in the brain? Or is it located in the brain entirely? We don't know. We believe that it cannot be explained entirely by biology or neuroscience, certainly not by the tools and categories that science has available to it today. It may seem strange to claim the existence of moral progress when there isn't even an objective standard of morality. But that's exactly what we find in human history. Progress comes not from new discoveries in an imaginary science of morality, but from being more honest and rigorous with ourselves, from uncovering our rationalizations and justifications for behavior that if we admit it, was pretty reprehensible from the start. Becoming better people is hard work, but by shifting through our biases and being open to new ideas, our ability to be good advances. As it said in the reading earlier, we are made of the same stuff as the rest of the universe, but our stuff is assembled in just the right way. This gives us great power, and with great power comes great responsibility. Singh seems to think that our evolutionary history, our genetic makeup, excuses us from the hard work of responsibility, of discovering objective moral truths. But that is to commit the categorical error of assuming that the language and techniques of biology can be used to fully describe our behavior. This is like assuming that the specific characteristic of molecules and chemical compounds can be understood strictly in terms of atomic and particle physics, or that a Van Gogh painting can be understood by analyzing the chemical makeup of the paints used. We are conscious, thoughtful beings. It is said that consciousness emerges from the activity of our brains. Some speculate that a sufficiently advanced artificial intelligence will someday become conscious. But consciousness is not explained in neurological terms. We can accept the biological evolutionary findings that altruistic behavior has at its core the desire to be liked, to be trusted, to be admired. But emerging from our biological makeup is the ability to understand and analyze our behavior. Knowing that at its roots, our ethical behavior is selfish, we have the ability and the obligation to transcend our biological roots and make our corner of the universe a better place. As Carroll says, science describes the world, but what are we going to do with that? But what we are going to do with that knowledge is a different matter. Moral philosophy from Hammurabi and Aristotle and Moses and Jesus to Kant and Fletcher and the UU principles and newly adopted bylaws has been made possible from our conscious ability to understand, acknowledge, and supersede our biological biases. So go ahead and freely reason about morality and ethics. Use that reasoning and guidance from other ethical thinkers to evaluate the morality and lack thereof of wars, political campaigns, our impact on the environment, and so on. In that process, remember our biological bias towards selfishness and use that awareness to look beyond self-serving. And by the way, feel free to look at the claims and assertions of others to see whether they stand up to what you understand to be the highest standards of morality, or whether they are simply manifestations of selfishness. We don't live in a post-moral age. At least I hope not.